like this, to learn more about Palestine, about the struggle of the Palestinian people. Myself, I was born in a refugee camp in the Gaza Strip. They were born in Britain. They probably have no connection with Palestine whatsoever. So it's very important that we bring our kids to these events to learn more about the struggle of their own people.
The public isn't really educated about the occupation that's going on in Palestine, and they kind of think just because it's going on for so long that it's something that's normal and dismissed, whereas events like this show us that it's not normal and we should fight for what we believe in.
It can never be just about art and culture. The festival, like the ones before, was also unapologetically political. The organisers called once again on the international community to end the occupation of Palestine. Former leader of the Labour Party, Jeremy Corbyn, was there to offer his support as well.
Nobody ever chooses to be a refugee. Nobody ever wants to leave their home, their community, their family, their place of birth, possibly never to return. They don't do it for fun. They do it out of desperation.
We asked Mr. Corbyn about the new Borders and Nationality Bill, which is being described as the most racist legislation in decades and could harm those seeking asylum in the UK.
Oppose the Borders and Nationality Bill. It's brutal, it's unnecessary, and it's demonising people who are desperate. Nobody gets into a boat to cross the English Channel unless they're really desperate. They are desperate people who end up on the shores of this country. They should be supported, they should be housed, they should be welcomed, because they're people fleeing from poverty, from oppression, and from environmental degradation.
The former Labour leader, who represents a growing number of British citizens and politicians that support the Palestinian cause, has been a figurehead of the resistance for decades, bringing hope to young Palestinians who dream of returning to their homeland. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Israeli military intelligence chief Tamir Heyman has admitted in an interview that Tel Aviv was involved in the January 2020 assassination of Iran's top commander, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, in a drone strike that also killed deputy chief of Iraq's popular mobilization unit, Abu Mehdi al-Muhandis, at Baghdad airport. The headline, however, didn't come as a surprise given initial reports on the role of informants in tipping the CIA about the whereabouts of the Iranian general on the day of the U.S. drone strike. It's not the first time Israel has been involved in such operations against Iran either. The regime assassinated four Iranian scientists between 2010 and 2012. In November last year, Iran's top nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh was assassinated in an attack that Iran says has Israel's fingerprints all over it. Tehran also points its finger at Tel Aviv for multiple sabotage attacks that have recently hit Iran's nuclear facilities in an abortive attempt to undermine the country's nuclear program. Despite Iran's repeated calls on the international community to hold the perpetrators responsible for the dangerous adventurism, neither the United Nations nor self-proclaimed promoters of human rights in the West have called for accountability or made any meaningful attempt to prevent similar attacks. That's also true about Israel's military action on nations like Syria and the regime's atrocities against the people of Palestine, all of which are considered as blatant violation of international law.
Because of the protection of the United States in the United Nations Security Council, flat out, this is what enables Israel to perpetuate its rogue activity regionally and globally, to perpetuate its terrorism, to perpetuate its ethnic cleansing and genocide against the Palestinian people, to continually bomb neighboring countries almost daily. It is the protection of the United States in the United Nations that enables Israel to act in this continually terroristic and scofflaw manner.
That begs the question, wouldn't the lack of international accountability legitimize Israel's state terrorism and embolden the regime to intensify its aggression?
The largest international gathering on Afghanistan since the US left the country in a chaotic situation. The extraordinary meeting of the OIC foreign ministers was convened in Islamabad to discuss the humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan. The meeting was attended by not just the OIC states, but permanent members of the UN Security Council, representatives of the UN agencies, and the international financial institutions. Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan called for the immediate help for the people of Afghanistan.
The point is that if not act, this will be the biggest man-made crisis which is unfolding in front of us. We, the OIC, it's a big responsibility on us, because not only is it the situation in Afghanistan as it unfolds, but it's a religious duty to help them.
The UN Undersecretary General on Humanitarian Affairs presented a grim picture of the Afghan situation.
Basic services that all Afghans depend on are collapsing as international development support, upon which the country has depended for so long, has frozen up. By the middle of next year, as estimated by UNDP, universal poverty may reach 97%.
The Iranian foreign minister proposed the establishment of a special fund to help the people of Afghanistan. He also called for the national reconciliation and inclusive government in Afghanistan. This was the second extraordinary meeting of the OIC on Afghanistan. The first one was also held in Islamabad 41 years ago, but the agenda at that time was to penalize the Soviet-backed regime in Kabul.
The meeting of the OIC foreign ministers came against the backdrop of worsening humanitarian situation in Afghanistan. According to the United Nations, nearly 23 million Afghans are facing acute food shortage. 97% of Afghan population could slip below the poverty line by June next year if urgent steps are not taken to mitigate their sufferings.
The acting Afghan foreign minister was also invited to the meeting. Officials say at this stage the priority is to avert the humanitarian crisis, and the question of recognition of the Taliban rule will come later. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
Anger was vented outside Downing Street Sunday as Britain's ethnic minorities demanded the government scrap the controversial new Nationality and Border Bill. The bill gifts the state new powers to remove citizenship without warning or a proper appeal process. Black, Asian and immigrant families are all expected to be targeted disproportionately by the new law change, sending fear ricocheting through communities.
Basically, what they're saying is that all that we've been working for as organizations, as generations of Muslims who exist in this country, belong to this country, whatever you've done doesn't really matter. You're a second-class citizen. And that is a dangerous narrative that they're presenting us with.
The fact that even though you're a British citizen, you're still affected if you're still from an ethnic minority country. So the fact that you're a member of the Sikh community, Muslim community, Hindu community, black community, you're not really safe here.
As members of the public, as just citizens of Britain, we are just pawns, mere pawns to them in their political games. Our lives are at stake, and that is not an exaggeration.
Despite government reassurances, critics have warned that the new bill could affect an estimated 6 million Britons who were born elsewhere or have a second nationality, and could be used by the state to punish minority citizens they want to get rid of.
The bill has already passed through the House of Commons at its third reading earlier this month. It's now been passed onto the House of Lords, where it will be debated further on January the 5th. The result of that debate could determine whether so many British citizens, particularly from ethnic minorities, can maintain their nationality going forward. Robert Carter, London.
The Iranian Foreign Ministry held a funeral ceremony for Hassan Irloo, Iran's ambassador to Yemen, who passed away due to acute COVID-19 on Tuesday morning, local time. The Iranian diplomat had tested positive for the coronavirus in Yemen. On Sunday, he was transferred to Iran for treatment using an Iraqi airliner. But a delay in his flight from Sana'a compounded his illness. Iran's foreign minister, Hossein Amir Abdollahian, held Saudi Arabia accountable for the passing away of the Iranian envoy, saying Riyadh impeded efforts for timely evacuation of the diplomat from Yemen.
We had for days been trying to obtain a permit through a third country to send a plane from Iran or another country to quickly transport Hassan Irloo to a well-equipped hospital in Iran. But unfortunately, the Saudi side made a very late decision in this regard, and some of the executive apparatuses in Saudi Arabia dragged their feet. We will officially register our protest based on international conventions.
Irlu officially began his diplomatic mission to Yemen's National Salvation Government in December 2020. A month later, the United States added him to the list of its sanctions in protest of Iran's ties with Yemen's Ansarullah movement. Ansarullah has been defending Yemen against the Saudi-led coalition's aggression, which enjoys full logistic support from the U.S. and U.K. Saudi Arabia and its allies invaded Yemen in 2015 with the aim of restoring power to Riyadh's favorite government. Some 7 years on, the invasion has claimed the lives of tens of thousands of Yemenis and brought Yemen close to the brink of outright famine.
During his short tenure as Iran's ambassador to Yemen, the Iranian diplomat made major efforts to facilitate Iran's humanitarian and medical aid to the war-torn country. So it's going to be missed by Yemenis who have been living under years of Saudi-imposed blockade that denies them access to relief supplies. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Martyrdom is the best deal one can strike with God.
This is the part of the speech delivered on October 16th, 2021 in a meeting with the officials in charge of the martyrs of Zanjan commemoration ceremony. The commemoration ceremony was held on October 28th, 2021.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Praise be to God, Lord of the worlds, and peace and greetings be upon our Master Muhammad and upon his pure household, especially the remnant of God on earth. First of all, I wish to welcome all of you, dear brothers and sisters, especially the members of the families of the martyrs who are here today, the Honourable Mother of Three Martyrs, and all those involved in conducting this important commemoration ceremony. I truly thank all of you for starting and doing this valuable work. God willing, you will continue and complete it. Please send my sincere regards to the friends who have sent their greetings, including the youth and members of religious gatherings.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united. The position and role of Zanjan in the history of Iran.
The city of Zanjan has achieved many accomplishments. Throughout history, Zanjan has earned many honors, both in scholarly areas and in action. These accomplishments have been achieved in the religious sciences, jurisprudence, philosophy and mysticism, and in social fields. There have been outstanding personalities with different orientations, but all of them have worked for and in the way of God. There have been personalities such as Akhund Mullah Qurban Ali and the like. Zanjan is truly an outstanding, exemplary city. Regarding the new sciences, our well-known martyr in nuclear sciences, Martyr Shahriari, was one of the honorable sons of the city of Zanjan. Therefore, Zanjan has accomplished many feats. The martyrs from this area, too, are at the top of the list of achievements registered by Zanjan. I will mention a few points about the martyrs, and then I will discuss your work, the move to commemorate martyrs. As for martyrs, martyrs are chosen ones, chosen by God, the Exalted. Martyrs have chosen the right path, and God chose them to reach the destination. The value of martyrs cannot be measured with our material calculations. The martyrs have won in the best deal in the world. O you who have faith, shall I show you a deal that will deliver you from a painful punishment? Have faith in Allah and His Apostle and wage jihad in the way of Allah with your possessions and your persons. The Holy Quran, Surah 61, verses 10 to 11. And it continues to the end. The big winners in this deal are our martyrs. Indeed, Allah has bought from the faithful their souls and their possessions for paradise to be theirs. The Holy Quran, Surah 9, verse 111. What is better than this deal?
I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
As former US President Donald Trump's loyalists laid siege to democracy with voting restrictions and attempts to take over the running of elections, there are fears that Democrats in Washington have not fully woken up to the threat. We are prepared for you an article written jointly by Sam Levine and David Smith. The piece is titled, US Republicans Are Shamelessly Working to Subvert Democracy. Are Democrats paying attention? As the first anniversary of the 6th of January insurrection at the U.S. Capitol approaches, there is no shortage of warnings about the danger of a repeat by Republicans. But even as former U.S. President Donald Trump loyalists lay siege to democracy with voting restrictions and attempts to take over the running of elections, there are fears that Democrats in Washington have not fully woken up to the threat. Tony Evers, the Democratic governor of Wisconsin, said, "At the state level, we're raising hell about it, but the Democrats on the national level are talking about Build Back Better, the infrastructure bill, and lots of other things." He added, "When we think about voting rights and democracy, I would hope we would hear a little bit more about that from the national level." Hopes that the attack on the Capitol would break the fever of Trumpism in the Republican Party were soon dashed. All but a handful of its members in Congress voted against the 9/11-style commission to investigate the riot, and many at national level have downplayed it, rallying to the former president's defense. But it is an attritional battle playing out state by state, county by county, and precinct by precinct that could pose the biggest menace to the next election in 2024, a potential rematch between Donald Trump and Joe Biden. An avalanche of voter suppression laws is being pushed through in Republican-led states, from Arizona to Florida, from Georgia to New Hampshire. Gerrymandered maps are being drawn up to form districts where demographics favor Republican candidates. Backers of Donald Trump's big lie of a stolen election are running to be the Secretary of State in many places, a position from which they would serve as the chief election official in their state. Donald Trump has endorsed such candidates in Michigan, in Arizona, in Georgia, and in Nevada, all crucial swing states. All-out assault suggests that Donald Trump and his allies learned lessons from their failed attempt to overturn the 2020 presidential election, identifying weak points in the system and laying the groundwork for a different outcome next time. Dean Phillips, a Democratic congressman from Minnesota, said, "It looks like Plan B is populating state-elected offices with believers of the big lie and morally corrupt candidates. We should all be concerned about that, and, by the way, not just Democrats, but everybody should be concerned." Yet, despite waves of media coverage, recently including The Atlantic magazine and The Guardian and New York Times newspapers, Democrats face the challenge of getting their voters to care. Many are confronting inflation, crime, and other priorities, and may assume that, having defeated Donald Trump last year, they can stop paying attention. Jay Inslee, the governor of Washington State, says, "It's still very difficult to imagine the severity and depth of what Donald Trump tried to pull off. It's hard sometimes to recognize something when it's new. For the president of the United States to try and stage a coup is unprecedented. It's hard for people to wrap their heads around it." Governor Jay Inslee of Washington State described Donald Trump as a clear and present danger who is trying to remove the impediments that rescued democracy last time. State governors are not only the ones sounding the alarm bells, but about the dangers of complacency or assuming that normal services has resumed. Jenna Griswold, a Colorado Democrat seeking re-election, is chair of the Democratic Association of Secretaries of State, which focuses on electing Democrats to those positions. She said, "While there's been a surge of attention from activists and donors to those races, it is not enough." She added, "I think one of the issues happening is that because this is the United States, the idea that our most fundamental freedom of living in a democracy is under attack is hard to really grasp." She added, "It's important that we keep leaning in because the folks on the other side are definitely leaning in." In Michigan, one of the leading candidates in the Republican field is Christina Camaro, who has spread lies about 6th of January and the election. She's seeking to oust Jocelyn Benson, a Democrat who became one of the most high-profile secretaries of state in 2020, when she took steps to make it easier to vote by mail in her state. Like Jenna Griswold, Jocelyn Benson, who describes herself as avowedly not a partisan, said she noticed increased interest from voters and independent donors, but not from the National Democratic Party. She said, "We're not seeing the same sense of urgency that perhaps the other side has shown in investing in these offices." She added, "With the exception of the vice president, who's been enormously supportive and gets the importance of these offices from a voting rights standpoint, I have seen no significant increase in support from national party leaders that what we experienced in 2018, which wasn't insignificant." Acolytes of the so-called Stop the Steal movement are drilling down even deeper, targeting local election oversight positions that have traditionally been non-partisan and little noticed, with only a few hundred votes at stake and candidates often running unopposed. Yet these too could pull at the threads of a democratic fabric. For example, in Pennsylvania, there is concern that election deniers are running for a position called Judge of Elections, a little-known office that plays a huge role in determining how things are run on election day. Scott Seabold, Pennsylvania State Director of All Voting Is Local, a voting advocacy group, said the role is essentially the top position at the precinct polling place on election day. He added, they could cause huge disruption at the polls based on how the office holder interprets rules around ID and spoiling mail-in ballots. Scott Seaborg agreed that not enough attention has been paid to these local races. He said, there's no precedent for this, as far as we know, in sort of the modern history of elections. I don't think folks anticipated this. I'm not sure how seriously entities like the Democratic Party are taking this, but they ought to. Similar anxieties emerged recently when the grassroots movement Indivisible ran a focus group with members from Georgia, Indiana, North Carolina, and elsewhere. Ezra Levin, the group's co-founder and co-executive director, said, they're worried about their governors, they're worried about their secretaries of state, and they're worried even at a more local level about previously non-partisan or uncontroversial election administration officials being taken over by a well-funded and very focused operation led by people who have embraced the big lie. Ezra Levin added, these are not positions, especially at the local level, that are getting as much attention, but it's real. We see Steve Bannon, former White House chief of staff and now a right-wing podcast, trying to lead the charge, getting folks to take up the lowest level spots in the election administration ecosystem. It's happening right in front of our own eyes. Ezra Levin, a former congressional staffer, noted that the Democratic Party is not a monolith, but warned that Joe Biden has devoted his political capital, traveling the country to make speeches, holding meetings on Capitol Hill, to causes such as infrastructure rather than the future of democracy, adding, this big missing puzzle piece in this entire fight for the last 11 months has been the president. Pressure on the Senate to act intensified these days when 17 governors wrote a joint letter expressing concern over threats to the nation's democracy. Evers of Wisconsin was among them. In a phone interview, he said Democrats in his crucial battleground state are highlighting the full-throated attack on voting rights, but acknowledged that voters have numerous other concerns as well. Evers added, everybody's talking about it, but when they go home from the Capitol and they're visiting with people, I'm guessing that the conversation talks about more bread and butter things like, I want my roads fixed, and thank you for reducing taxes.
Voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of information.
The Spotlight.
As if the bombing carried out by the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen was not bad enough, which has included targeting Yemen's airport in Sana'a, The WFP, World Food Program, has announced that it was forced to cut aid to Yemen due to lack of funds, warning of a surge in hunger in the war-torn country. In this edition of the Spotlight, we will look at why there is a will when it comes to selling Saudi Arabia military arms and weapons, but not enough of one to help the country on a humanitarian basis.
A Saudi attack hit Sana'a International Airport on Monday. The airport in the Yemeni capital has been one of the main targets of the Saudi military campaign since it began more than 6 years ago. And the recent raid caused severe damage to the facility.
The navigation equipment at the airport was broken 2 days before the airstrike. We have sent a letter to the relevant organization and have purchased the equipment for the tower. The equipment here has been used for more than 7 years, and the related accessories are not available at the local market. In order to ensure the safety requirements applicable to international standards, the Sana'a International Airport system has been unable to operate. Now you can see that the refueling equipment has been completely destroyed after the air attack, along with the refueling vehicles.
Flights into the airport have largely ceased due to the Saudi-led blockade since August 2016. 8 flights, however, were exempted, but now they're suspended following the Monday attack. Saudi Arabia has intensified its air raids on Yemen in recent weeks. That comes as the Yemeni army and its allied Ansar Allah forces are moving closer to fully liberate Ma'rib province, a key region and a major stronghold of the loyalists of the Saudi-backed former regime. Riyadh began its war on Yemen to reinstate that friendly regime led by Abdul Rabbah Mansour Hadi. That goal, however, has not materialized, with the civilian population only bearing the brunt of the war. The UN says hundreds of thousands of Yemeni civilians have been killed, while many more face lack of basic supplies. On Wednesday, the World Food Program warned that it will have to reduce food rations for millions of Yemenis because it's running out of funds.
From January, 8 million will receive a reduced food ration, while 5 million at immediate risk of slipping into famine conditions will remain on a full ration.
The UN Children's Agency, UNICEF, has alarming figures, too. It says about 2.3 million children under the age of 5 suffer from acute malnutrition. Of them, 400,000 are expected to face life-threatening severe malnutrition in the coming months. All those figures are the latest that international bodies have provided to show how life goes on for Yemenis under relentless Saudi strikes and its blockade. But the international community takes no practical action to end the Saudi war. Riyadh's Western allies are silent, too, despite their claims of being the world's leading human rights defenders.
For guests joining us for this edition of The Debate, we have Brett Yonkers, historian and a journalist from Hassel. Also joining us is Robert Fantina, author, journalist, and activist, who joins us from Kitchener, Ontario.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, welcome to you both. Brett Yonkers, I'll start with you in taking a look at an occurrence here that is very alarming, and that is how Saudi-led coalition forces is targeting Yemen's airport in Sana'a. What is the purpose behind that? We know, obviously, that that airport, if it's used, is used for humanitarian purposes as far as we know.
Yes, indeed. That is the aggravating and very, like, the most horrible thing about all of this, aside from the fact that they are bombing a civilian airport. The most aggravating thing is this is not a military airport, but it's not even a normal standard civilian airport, which has an economic purpose in a normal situation. You know, you could say that in other circumstances, perhaps Saudi Arabia was thinking of disrupting, you know, Yemen's economy in order to force the people to surrender, and that's why they're bombing the airport. That by itself would still be a war crime, and at least there would have been some sort of logic behind it. No, what makes this worse is that Sana'a International Airport isn't even a regular functioning commercial airport either. It hasn't been since at least 2016 because of the total blockade, aerial, land, and naval blockade that exists against Yemen. There are no flights, commercial flights, in and out of Yemen. There haven't been in years. The only use that Sana'a International Airport has seen for at least the past 5 years is humanitarian aid, is UN flights, in the United Nations, UNICEF, things at the World Food Program. They are all sending humanitarian life-saving aid to more than 50% of the population in the entire country through either naval transport through Hodeida port, which is also very often under blockade and under bombing, or through air transport to Sana'a International Airport. We have seen just recently, just days ago, it was mentioned in the topics of the day, just now on Press TV as well. Just days ago, Hassan Irlou, the ambassador of the Islamic Republic of Iran to Yemen, died of COVID-19 complications because of the fact that it took so long to get a proper safe flight out of Sana'a, even for diplomatic personnel like him, to get a safe flight out of Sana'a to go to Iraq and eventually to return to Iran for medical treatment. It took so long that eventually it killed him. So that goes to show that this airport is used exclusively for humanitarian purposes, and even that the Saudis are trying to prevent, just to kill more Yemenis and to increase the suffering even further.
Okay, let's talk about the humanitarian situation. We have to, Robert Fantina. We've been talking about it for, as far as I remember, but it's going on about 6 years or more. And the World Food Program has came out with an alarming announcement that is forced to cut the aid due to lack of funds, as it has said, and it has warned, as a result of that, a surge to happen in hunger in the in Yemen, which it said from January, 8 million will receive a reduced food ration. I'm quoting the WFP spokesperson, while 5 million will be at immediate risk of slipping into famine conditions and will remain on a full ration. This coming from the UN agency, actually, who said in a statement, because they're running out of funds. What can be done when you hear about this alarming announcement coming from the WFP at a country that's already ravaged by shortage of food and other deficiencies that it's experiencing?
There is so much that can be done. I'm glad you mentioned the fact that these figures, shocking as they are just a continuation of the conditions that have existed in Yemen for a number of years now, of the amount of people starving and close to starvation, homeless because of bombing, exposed to the elements, unable to get medical treatment, and so on. It has been horrific for years now. And what can be done today? So much can be done. First of all, the United States, which supports Saudi Arabia in every way imaginable, sells it weapons that it uses on Yemeni people, supports it diplomatically. The United States could prevent it. The United States could simply say, this isn't going to happen anymore, and tell Saudi Arabia to stop the bombing. And the United States could provide humanitarian aid, all the humanitarian aid that Yemen needs, if it chose to do so. However, that would impede or reduce the profits that United States companies make on their weapons. It would do nothing to enhance the United States' hegemony in that part of the world, which is very important to it. Now, it makes sense to me that by helping beleaguered people, the United States would gain popularity. But that's not what the United States is interested in. It's only interested in power and profits, and the Saudi government assists it in achieving those unholy goals. So the fact that millions of people, including children, innocent children, and most of the men and women who are at risk also, have nothing to do with any military. They're at risk of suffering horrific deaths. Death by starvation is horrific. And yet the United States will stand by and allow it to happen simply because it isn't interested in individuals in that part of the world. It's only interested in assuring that there are governments in that part of the world that will do its bidding.
Well, let's talk about some numbers here in terms of the U.S., Brett Yonkers, if I may. Now, in the 5 years before the war, the U.S. actually sold Saudi Arabia arms, what are called arms transfers, to the tune of about $3 billion. And then you have the years 2015 to 2020, 2015 when the war started, and you have that figure spiked to $64.1 billion, and that is a conservative estimate. We're talking about weapons, cruise missiles, et cetera. So that's roughly about $10.7 billion per year. And then you have the WFP that says it needs $813 million to continue to help with the starving children and, of course, other avenues where this money can go in terms of helping Yemenis. So, Mike, the conclusion that can be reached here, if you agree, is that the U.S. can sell weapons with this amount of revenue coming in, but it won't help Yemenis who are dying because of the weapons that it's selling, Saudi-led coalition. Is that a correct deduction?
Yes, absolutely. I think that is a very clear-cut and very to-the-point analysis. It is a fact that imperialism as a system, and especially U.S. imperialism as it has existed at least since 1945 and probably before that as well, is a system that is completely devoid of any form of humanity. They don't even think about the suffering that they are causing and the suffering that is going on in that part of the world. And even when they do mention it, when they talk about, you know, the people who are suffering and dying in Yemen or in the wider Arab world or in Africa or in Asia, they talk about it as if it is a fact of life that just happens to exist. There just happens to be poverty. There just happens to be starvation and children are dying. And then they might collect some, it's a couple of million, mostly from charity that is donated by, you know, ordinary American people and ordinary people across the West, not even really the money that comes from the government itself. And then they might send some money through some NGO or humanitarian organization to try to basically throw some, you know, drops on the hot plate in order to try, quote unquote, solve the situation that way. But what they never do is talk. They never talk about why this is happening. They never talk about the reasons. They never analyze the causes. Mm-hmm. And the reason why is because the powers that be, especially the government, the media concerns, the military-industrial complex, they know very well that it is their own fault. It is their doing. They are very well aware of that, and they're trying to do everything they can in order to ensure that people don't catch on to that fact too much. Sure. They don't like to talk about the fact that Saudi Arabia would never have launched this war to begin with back in 2015 if they did not have the green light from the Obama administration back then. This is all part of a diabolical system. If there's no better way of saying it, I believe. It's a diabolical system that is all about, indeed, as the other guests said, about profit and about power. That's the only thing they care about. Even if it would be much, much cheaper to just, you know, feed the world rather than spend all the money on constructing and developing new weapons, in the end, it's about the profit for a small, very small, minuscule margin of the upper class of society. That's the only thing that matters at this point.
Well, I'm trying to figure out, Robert Fantino, what is the thinking behind Joe Biden? Because we know on his campaign trail, he said he's going to stop the war in Yemen. When he came into office, he said that that's going to happen. But then it didn't. And he said, we are stopping arms sales except for arms that are going to be used for quote-unquote defensive purposes. Okay? And then from there, we went just weeks ago where you had the $650 million sale of missiles and missile launchers, which was allowed to be sold to Saudi Arabia. So from stopping the war to the sale of defensive weapons to actually having the $650 million sale. Who is pressuring Biden, or what is the thinking behind there?
Part of the pressure comes from Congress, which finances its campaigns. For Congress members finance their campaigns for re-election from lobbyists, and the so-called defense industry is very generous to Congress members who will do its bidding and vote for these excessive sales. Biden can justify this by saying these are defensive weapons. He can't say how Saudi Arabia is going to use them, but he can call them defensive all he wants to, but they certainly are not. But he's getting pressure from Zionists who want to defeat any nation that might pose any opposition to Israel. He's getting pressure from Congress members who want to keep the campaign dollars flowing. He is not a man of great integrity and principles. He will say whatever is politically expedient at the time, such as during the campaign, saying that he would end arms sales to Saudi Arabia. He would be sure that the constant attack on Yemen ceases, because he knows that's what people want to hear. However, the U.S. government is not responsive to the citizenry. Their constituency, the elected officials' constituency, are lobby groups, corporations, and military contractors. So that's whose bidding they do. They'll say whatever they need to say to get elected, and then they will do what those organizations and individuals tell them to do.
Let's rewind back, Brett Yonkers, to March of 2021. That was when the U.S. President Joe Biden announced that it's going to cut its support for and this particular entry set for offensive operations in Yemen, which many translated that, or many deducted or interpreted U.S.'s announcement that it would be defensive weapons that it would sell to Saudi Arabia. But it was interesting, this particular headline that said this is not going to help end the war because the U.S. Will not have any concessions to offer the Ansar al fighters or the National Salvation Government. When it says the U.S. will not have concessions, you kind of take a step back, saying, wait a minute, is the U.S. fighting in this war directly, or is it Saudi and the Saudi-led coalition doing the fighting? And my question to you is, many analysts have said if the U.S. wanted this war to stop, it could do so with a phone call. Is that true? Do you agree?
I think to a significant extent that is definitely true. And that is, I always refer back to the statement back years ago made by then President Donald Trump, in which he talked again to the people at a rally. Again, like Ms. Fantino said, to the people, telling the people what they want to hear. But he told people that he spoke to the King of Saudi Arabia, to King Salman, and that he told King Salman that he has to bear in mind that without U.S. support, his regime would crumble. Now, whether or not he actually, you know, said that to King Salman in person is irrelevant. The thing is that is basically a lapsus by Donald Trump, in which he spoke a rare gem of absolute truth, because that is definitely what is going on here. And that's why I say, we say that this is Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman's war. And in a way it is. He's the one who has been steering it internally. He is the one who has been pulling the power to himself internally in Saudi Arabia. But behind Saudi Arabia are these vested interests of the imperialist powers of the world, most importantly, the United States. Saudi Arabia is, as a country, was founded by the United Kingdom, by British imperialism, and later on was basically handed over, instead of British imperialists, their main backers and main supporters nowadays, their bosses in a way, are the United States. So the Saudis as a regime are incredibly weak, because this is a kingdom built almost exclusively on petroleum. They are trying now, they had an entire Agenda 2030, which has been failing for the most part, in which they're trying to diversify their economy. But they have this concept of they believe that they can live in unbridled and unlimited luxury based on nothing else except for oil and U.S. support. So I believe this is definite too, indeed. And as you see, when the United States says we won't give any concessions, what they mean is that they will not want to give in at all to what Ansar Allah or the National Salvation Government of Yemen are demanding, which is an inclusive democratic government indeed for all the people in Yemen. That is the goal of the revolution in 2014. But when the United States says that they are not making concessions, that is, I think, the reason why Saudi Arabia still continues this war. We know there have been whistleblowers several times already. We know that the Saudi armies and the Saudi high command knows that this war is unwinnable. We know that there are politicians and princes even in the Al Saud family who have spoken out in private, of course, against this conflict, because exactly, they know this is unwinnable. But still, they will continue. And the only way the Saudis know how to continue this war, because they don't dare to send actual Saudi troops to fight and die in the desert in Yemen, the only way they know to continue this war is by bombing. That's all they have been, that sure. They know. They try to bomb as much as they can. And I think this comes, the directive, indeed, the order in the end, comes from the Pentagon, comes from the CIA, and comes from the White House.
We're not only talking about the U.S. here, Robert Pensina. We're also talking about other countries that are selling arms to Yemen, such as France and the U.K. And one of the most disturbing facts on top of all the other ones, which is the latest U.N. figures, has said that more than 16 million Yemenis, about half of the approximately 30 million population, is going to face hunger this year, and 50,000 are already starving to death. You know, you have to take a deep breath here, and I'm ending this spotlight with this question to you. There's a large failure that's taking place on a humanitarian level across the world when it comes to Yemen. A movement needs to be occurring here, especially with the fact that the WFP says that the funds are not there. How do you suggest that the world can move forward on this?
Well, first of all, it's appalling to think that in 2021, this many people are facing starvation. Not only hunger, but starvation resulting in death. The countries of the world have the resources to prevent this. It's just a matter of their will. Now, as we've seen in the past, the governments will not act until the people within their countries demand that they act. This means voting out people who are only concerned about power and profits. It means supporting candidates who are willing to make changes, make significant changes in the way their governments are operating, and especially in their foreign policies in this context. England and France, and certainly the United States, are complicit in all of Saudi Arabia's war crimes and crimes against humanity. The people in those countries do not necessarily support these horrific crimes, but they need to act to see that the government officials who are complicit are removed from office. Additionally, NGOs need to take a huge step. Their hands are tied, certainly, because they're afraid of being bombed, and it's a reasonable fear if they go into Yemen. But these organizations need to act and act in opposition to the governments under which they live in order to see that the people of Yemen do not starve to death by the millions, which is the current threat.
Thank you very much. We're going to end it there. That's Robert Pensina, author, journalist, and activist from Kitchener. And Brett Yonkers, thank you for your contribution, historian and journalist there from Hessel. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. Thanks so much. Until next time, from me, Kavitawe, entire team in the capital, Tehran, it's goodbye.